This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. On the local news roundup, CMPD officer Brentley Vinson is not charged in the shooting death of Keith Scott. Protests follow that decision. The governor's race remains too close to call as Roy Cooper's lead widens. Pat McCrory's chances for a win hinge now on a recount in Durham County. Fires in the North Carolina mountains are under control, but in Tennessee, Gatlinburg and parts of Pigeon Forge are devastated. South Carolina Governor Nikki Haley is on her way to the United Nations as President-elect Trump's choice to be ambassador, and Charlotte approves the massive River District development. Our roundtable of reporters is set to talk about those stories and more. We're joined by David Borax from WFAE News, along with Nick Oxner from WBTV News. Welcome back, gentlemen.
Good morning.
Morning, Mike. Morning.
Glenn Birkins, editor and publisher of QCityMetro.com, is here with Eric Frazier, editorial writer for the Charlotte Observer. Good to see both of you again.
Morning. Thank you.
Good morning.
And you can reach us through email at charlottetalks@wfae.org or search for WFAE on Facebook or get to us through Twitter at Charlotte Talks. You can use the hashtag WFAE Roundup. Mecklenburg County District Attorney Andrew Murray announced on Wednesday that his office would not be filing charges against the CMPD officer who shot and killed Keith Scott back in September. That shooting, of course, sparked protests and riots and revealed distrust in the black community of CMPD and other city officials. So why no charges? Who wants to take that?
Well, apparently it would take about 50 minutes to explain.
And I know.
Say that as a good thing because the district attorney spent about that much time walking through point by point the evidence and explaining all of the reasons. And he said ultimately that the facts taken all together as a totality in the circumstances led him to conclude that Officer Vinson feared for his life and the life of others and used lethal force.
He used that time to really build a case point by point that the suspect, Mr. Scott, had a gun and that the officers felt threatened. And he was really responding in many ways to the rumors and social media that people have put out over the last couple of months. And it was a point-by-point, almost like a court case, I think.
I'm as skeptical I'm as skeptical about most things as anyone, but I left that briefing convinced, absolutely convinced, that there wasn't a jury in the United States that would have convicted the officer, and rightly so. There was a lot of misinformation out there, apparently, and I think D.A. Murray did a great job of putting that aside.
Well, he said, the D.A. said, that Scott stepped out of his vehicle with a gun in his hand and ignored at least 10 commands, which we've all heard on those tapes, from the five officers on the scene to drop the gun. It is impossible from the police dash and the body cam video really to see a gun in Mr. Scott's hand. So how did the DA reach the conclusion that he had one in his hand?
Well, multiple witnesses, I believe, in that, right? He said that, well, I know that they also had tape from right before that, I think it was, of Mr. Scott going into a convenience store and showing the bulge on where the ankle holster would have been. I believe, well, when I said witnesses, I guess I mean the officers on the scene who all said that he had a gun, and that's why they were shouting, drop the gun, drop the gun, drop the gun.
But he never raised the gun.
We don't know that.
Yeah, that is, of all the questions that have been answered this week, that one remains unanswered. But the other significant thing is that after the DA's presentation, an attorney for the Scott family did acknowledge that he believed now that Keith Lamont Scott did have a gun, which is something that even his wife had disputed previously. Right. So I think we all agree now that he had a gun. I don't know that it is settled what he was doing with the gun at the time that he was shot.
The big question that wasn't answered by that press conference and by the report that's on the DA's website right now is, why did the situation escalate the way it did? Why did the cops bang on his window to try and break it? Were they calling him out of the car? You know, what brought it to that point where he felt threatened himself, probably, and why did they feel threatened?
In reading how many pages was the transcript of the interview that the police did with the officer who
70
shot?
Or 80 pages with Vinson, yeah.
Well, let me tell you, I didn't read all of it, but I read a lot of it. And evidently, when they pulled up, wasn't he pulling out like a Tipperillo or something like that? And he cut into it to dump the tobacco and allegedly had a medicine vial and it looked like he was going to put marijuana where the tobacco
was described as a cigarillo. So they saw him with a joint. That wasn't of that much interest to them. Remember, they were there to serve a warrant in an unrelated case. Then a little while later, they saw him with a gun, and that kind of raised their interest a little bit. They left the scene. They put on gear for a possible violent situation, and they went back and they confronted him. And that's when they were asking him to get out of the car, and he wouldn't get out of the car initially.
And by the way, if listeners would like to read that transcript, it is on our website at WFAE.org.
That was a good point.
Why it escalated so quickly is really the point or the question that we should all be asking, not just in this instance, I believe, but I think, and I've said on this show before, that I think it's time that we really reexamine the role of de-escalation in policing. Just a couple decades ago, it was common for police to engage in high-speed car chases. They figured out that was not smart. It wasn't safe for the police officer. It wasn't safe for the public. And so they said, okay, we won't do this as often anymore unless it really calls for it. We'll pull back, we'll wait, and we'll pick the guy up later. Surely some similar philosophy can be adopted overall to policing, where you don't have to rush in and execute an arrest immediately.
Well, I think what's going to be interesting with the change of administrations right now is that President Obama has been pushing a closer look at issues like de-escalation through its, I think it's called the 21st Century Commission on Policing that came up in the wake of Ferguson and all these other things that have happened, where they're looking at the way that the police interact with the public and trying to find a better way forward. Now, what will Jeff Sessions and Donald Trump make of that? And will they try to go in a totally different direction, stop and frisk, rather than, de-escalating?
I think cities are going to have to take the lead on this.
Well, the other question, let's go back to the car chase, right? Had Keith Monscott been stopped at a car at the end of a pursuit, right, and they knew he had a weapon, they would have done a felony stop, with the cops behind their doors, driver, put your hands out the window, one step at a time. And we didn't see that here. We saw a bang on the window, surround him. That was not a felony stop, which is what you would think and which is what police are trained to do when you know you're dealing with an armed subject. And had they done that, it makes you wonder what the outcome would have been. But, that is my biggest question, is why we have a procedure in place, because you do a thing like a felony stop, which is puts the officers in safety, which gives the officers theoretically greater control of the subject in the car that they think could be dangerous. You do that to de-escalate situations and to prevent what we had.
And here, it's important to note that Andrew Murray's report and his press conference did not address that. He was asked, and he said, "My role here is only to determine whether charges should be filed in this case. Yeah. I cannot comment on whether the police followed their own procedures in this case."
And the internal affairs investigation continues within CMPD.
So one of the things that we learned as a result of this press conference that Mr. Murray gave was that the gun was stolen. Mr. Scott bought the gun, I think, 18 days before the confrontation, and they found the gun, they say, with one bullet in the chamber. I'm not a gun person, so I guess that means it was ready to fire. Is that correct?
The safety was off. It was cocked. Right.
And the DA says that Scott told the person from whom he bought the gun that he was buying it because he was having problems with his wife and her family, specifically his nephew. At the time of the shooting, Mrs. Scott said he doesn't have a gun. Now, are we to believe that she believed that he didn't have the gun on the scene at the time, or that he didn't own a gun?
Well, they'd said he didn't own a gun, but the DA now says that the SBI recovered text messages from like the week before where Keith Scott and his wife were talking about in text a gun.
And how did they find, if the gun was stolen, they can figure that out from the serial number on the gun, but how did they know who he bought the gun from? How did they find that individual?
I believe the guy came forward and said that he had sold him the gun. And they did also have some, I believe there were Facebook messages between the guy that sold him the gun and another third party discussing it, in which one of the guys says, "I hope it's not the same gun, but I think it is,"
And you talked about, I think, Glenn, you talked about social media rumors that were rampant after this shooting and through the protests and riots that followed. Was DA Murray successful in your mind in debunking those rumors? It sounded to me like it was.
I think he was. According to Murray, just about everyone who said they actually saw the shooting recanted when they were interviewed by the SBI. Those who said they saw a book, him reading a book or get out of the SUV with a book, they recanted. Those who said this or that or the other, under closer examination, they all changed their stories.
They didn't just recant. They said, I actually wasn't at the scene.
Yeah, I actually didn't even see anything. And it's not just social media. I mean, it wasn't just people sending a tweet or something. It's people getting on Facebook Live and broadcasting what they saw. It was people talking to us as journalists and saying, I was an eyewitness and I was there and this is what I saw. And, you know, I think the DA spent a lot of time and seemed particularly to push back on those people, and you know, that many have pointed to as being the reason that we had some.
Which
violence.
Brings up a letter to the editor this morning. It's one thing to lie to journalists, I suppose. It's another thing to lie to police. And if they are now recounting previous testimony to police, the letter to the editor this morning suggests they should be prosecuted, should they?
Murray actually was asked that. He addressed it during the conference. Somebody asked him about Scott's wife and some of her statements, which turned out not to be true. And he said, I'm not interested in pursuing that right now.
Okay. Yeah. You were there with Lisa Wharf at that press conference, and a lot of people have seen these recordings, videos of what happened that day from various different angles that don't tell the whole story. But from what he told you, the district attorney said about what happened that day, does it jive with the videos, what we know from the videos?
It jives. Here's the way I would describe it. You know, we have the videos and we think we know what we can see there. He acknowledged during the press conference that you cannot see a gun in Scott's hand. What he was trying to do, this might have played out in a trial where the prosecutor laid out a case. Well, that's what he was doing this week. And he tried to build a case point by point that Scott did have a gun, that he owned a gun, that he did have it with him. Eric referred earlier to the trip to the convenience store. He had an ankle holster that fit the profile of the gun and holster that they found on the scene. Again, piece by piece, he built a case that Scott did have a gun and that he was ready to use it. Now, the only other testimony that we have is from the officers who said that they saw it and they felt threatened. That's something new as well. I mean, we didn't have that until now.
Well, the family's lawyers, Scott's lawyers, say that the confrontation with police could have ended peacefully. And I guess we've talked a little bit about maybe focusing on de-escalation. But given that he ignored 10 commands to drop the gun, why do they feel that it could have ended peacefully?
Well, I think it probably, and I'm not speaking for the family, of course, but I think it probably goes back to the medication.
Yeah.
I think even Murray admitted that the medication that Scott was on probably affected him in some ways.
He was a little dazed.
He was a little dazed, and I think there was a question of how much he heard and comprehended, his reaction time, all of that.
And I said earlier that he didn't raise the gun, at least in the portion of the video in which we can see Mr. Scott just before he is fired on by police. His hands are down. They are not up. So why would that be a justification for lethal force?
Well, I think what they've said is that officers aren't required to wait until they're, being fired upon to neutralize what they perceive as a deadly threat.
Okay. There's still no decision in the governor's race, believe it or not. It's Friday, 3.5 weeks after the election. We'll get to that and lots of other things as we go through the hour here, the local news roundup on Charlotte Talks on WFAE. We're coming right back. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members at High Point University's Access to Innovators series featuring Dr. Nido Quabane's conversation with Dr. Carol Dweck, airing Thursday, December 8th at 10 p.m. on UNC TV. More information at highpoint.edu. And PNC Wealth Management, the PNC team, can provide insights that help customers make the most of their wealth. More information from Jennifer Green at 704-686-2129. Dylan Roof, the accused shooter in the Charleston church massacre, is exercising his constitutional right to represent himself in his death penalty trial. It's a decision that has not ended well for others who tried it. And we talked to two attorneys on Monday about how this case might turn out. And then we hear from two politicians on opposite sides of the HB2 divide about what steps need to be taken to repair the damage caused by the bill. That's on Monday at 9.
On the next Diane Rehm Show, the Friday News Roundup, President-elect Donald Trump starts a victory tour with a stop in Cincinnati. Nancy Pelosi is re-elected House Minority Leader. And North Carolina prosecutors say the police officer who killed Keith Lamont Scott will not face charges.
The News Roundup continues with the Diane Rehm Show from 10 to noon on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE.
It's Charlotte Talks on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE and 90.3 WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. It's the local news roundup. David Borax is here from WFAE News. Nick Oxner from WBTV. Glenn Birkins, editor-publisher of QCityMetro.com, and Eric Frazier, editorial writer for the Charlotte Observer. Following Murray's District Attorney Murray's press conference, there was, in fact, a protest downtown, a peaceful protest. It began at the police department and then moved its way toward the epicenter, where it did get a little raucous for a moment or two. This was organized by a group called Charlotte Uprising. Who were they? Anybody know?
I don't know a whole lot about them. All I know about them is from their Twitter feed, frankly, and they seem really aggressive and really determined and really focused on confronting the police over incidents like this.
Well, Wednesday was a dark and stormy night. It rained really heavily at some points, and even downtown.
Tornado, too.
Yeah, did that kind of quell things, you think? Would it have gotten bigger than the 100 people who showed up?
It seems reasonable to assume that.
Because I think four people were arrested.
Yeah. Great. Mm-hmm. When you think about the fact that 100 people came out on a night when it tornadoed, imagine what it would have been if it were clear in 70.
Well, the protesters were asking for more transparency in police operations. Are we likely to see that here, given what we've seen so far?
The police department has committed, in a statement that came out after the DA's announcement, to doing at least some transparent things. And I'll give them credit for announcing a new policy in which the police department says it will request that body cam and dash cam footage of incidents that result in death or serious injury, so like in the Keith Scott case, for instance, that they will, as a policy, request that video be released from a judge. Because remember, under the new law—
After the investigation, though, isn't it?
Well, some nebulous at a time when we feel it would no longer hamper the investigation.
Exactly.
So what that means is still open to interpretation, but it is still better because, remember, under the new law that took effect in October, even police departments and police chiefs, despite what they had initially claimed, even police departments don't have the authority to release their own video. But so to have – they may be – I was talking with an open records person yesterday. They may be the first police department to explicitly acknowledge that and to implement a policy proactively. That would call for them to proactively release that.
Now, I was downtown last night, and I did see about six or seven or eight people with signs, and I just leapt to the conclusion that they were here to protest, but I've heard no reports of protests from last night.
Yeah, I don't believe there was any protest last night. Okay. The police put out an after-the-evening report that said no press, no protests, no arrests, no action. So,
okay. But they were ready. We've seemed to have learned a lot in a few short months.
Kirby emails, there was talk of a possible civil lawsuit by the Scott family. What would the basis of such a lawsuit be if police and prosecutors say no crime was committed? We don't have a lawyer on the panel.
Well, totally different standards.
Yeah. You could still have a civil lawsuit to even,
On what basis, though?
Don't know what policies they've – we don't still don't know if the – police department violated any of their own policies.
Simply because a crime wasn't committed doesn't negate the possibility of it being a wrongful death.
Keep in mind that the family of Jonathan Farrell reached a large settlement with the city, and we know how that case ended.
Okay. Let's move on. to the governor's race, which continues. They're like little gerbils in a cage. They must
no
be
one
really
in that
tired.
Race is moving on.
Roy Cooper's lead over Pat McCrory in the governor's race has now widened. I think it's – last time I checked, it was just under 10,000 votes.
It's just over 10,000.
Just over
10,000.
Well, then doesn't that end it? Because you can't ask for a recount, can you, if you have 10,000 votes?
Assuming what happens with the Durham recount of 94,000 votes, assuming that doesn't bring him back down under – bring the margin back under 10,000, then, yeah, it's –
Those 90,000 votes from Durham County came in late in the evening on election evening and put Roy Cooper over the top, much to the chagrin and I think to the surprise at the time of Pat McCrory. The three Republicans on the Board of Elections voted for the recount of those votes, saying that the late addition of those 90,000 votes to the statewide tally on election night constituted an irregularity. Why?
Well, not necessarily the timing of when they came in, but how they were added. And the reason they were late is because elections officials were having to manually enter those results. These were all from early voting. And Durham had every bit of computer technology at the Durham Board of Elections failed, essentially. And so they were having to manually enter ticker tape from the machine and having to read those results and enter them in.
And so manually.
Yeah, and so there's been lots of questions about what kind of error that, you know, could have been surrounded.
With 90,000 votes, I'm surprised they're not still doing that.
Well, they did it right after the election. They had to enter them manually. And as we've reported, you know, there was people from both the Democratic and Republican parties there watching this. So there, at the time, there wasn't really any question. It's just that they came in later than expected.
So when might – they started the recount, correct?
Yeah.
They have to be done. An order came out yesterday saying they must be done by 7 o'clock on Monday.
Monday, yeah.
And prior to that, the chairman of the Durham County Board of Elections had said, well, we'll do it sometime next week. And you kind of get the sense that the state says, no, we want to get this done. Yeah. You'll have it done by Monday at 7.
There's also still the question of a couple of hundred ballots, questionable absentee ballots in Bladen County. That will have no that won't change the outcome at all, will it?
Not enough to change the outcome.
Okay. So once this recount of the 90,000 votes is over, is the race over or could there be other
If the margin is greater than 10,000, I would think it would be over, but who knows?
Except we still have the question now, one other question out there of the lawsuit that was filed by Civitas against the Board of Elections regarding same-day registrations.
Yeah.
And so they're essentially challenging the process by which we same-day register people and that voters and then verify subsequently after they register their residency. Mm-hmm. And if that happens, then that could – who knows if it would or not, but if a judge sustained that challenge, then that would draw into question a whole new subset of voters. But for that, yes, we will be done theoretically.
And yesterday on Channel 3, Nick, you reported on the Cooper campaign returning an illegal campaign contribution made by a PAC. How much was it? Why was it considered illegal? How did it come to light?
Yeah, well, it came to light because I'm a glutton for punishment and like to sift through.
You are the Stuart Watson of WBTV.
I'll take that as a compliment. So the contribution was for $1,000. It was made by the Southern Alliance for Clean Energy, which is a group that seems to be most active in Florida. They also have a small presence in Asheville, and they are a political action fund registered with the Federal Elections Commission federally, but they are not registered in North Carolina. And in North Carolina, you must be registered in the state with the State Board of Elections in order to make a contribution to a candidate. And so we were just going through, as I do because I'm bored and that's what I get paid to do, and looking, you know, through details, and we noticed that this PAC was not registered, and so we called the Cooper campaign, and their response to us was, yep, we've returned that money. And the PAC says that they, you know, it was their fault, they didn't know, and they should have known. Now, it's interesting to say that both candidates, you know, raised millions and millions of dollars. Roy Cooper took in about $300,000 from outside groups. Pat McCrory took in about $550,000 from PACs. So in the grand scheme of things, PAC money, PACs dumped hundreds of thousands, nearly $1 million into the governor's race. But as a percentage of the whole amount of dollars at play here, really not that much, which I find to be interesting.
But just to be sure people know that you're on both sides of this fence, you also reported on Pat McCrory and some allegations that are coming up about his use of an airplane for the campaign.
We've continued to investigate and track his use of state airplanes. And what we most recently have uncovered is the fact that the governor was using the state airplane to fly to political events, which he can do by law so long as he reimburses, depending on the situation, at least half of or up to all of the cost of the use of that plane. And we have found multiple instances now where the governor definitely used the plane to fly to a political event like an RGA conference or something, but there is no record of the campaign or of the Republican Governors Association or anyone else having reimbursed that cost.
Is this why Donald Trump calls the media very, very bad people? Is that why? People
crooked,
like you.
Crooked media.
I'm dishonest. Called that by all sides, so I'll take that as a compliment.
So Jennifer Roberts says, I'm in. She sent out an email earlier this week. She's in. Saying she hoped everybody had a wonderful Thanksgiving holiday last week. And she's grateful for the chance to serve. And in case you haven't heard, I am running for re-election so I can continue to serve Charlotte for another term. Isn't this a little early?
No.
Correct me if I'm wrong. I think she had already announced months ago that she was going. She had officially kicked off her reelection campaign months ago, and this was just a reminder of, hey, I am running.
When's the actual election? Next November?
Yes.
Good Lord. Already?
Well, she didn't want to make sure we went without a campaign going. It was
these
kind
days,
of,
I think it's become a tradition that once one election is done, you should expect a slew of announcements.
The perpetual campaign.
It used to be,
but more than more than that, with everything that happened with the shooting and the subsequent debate over releasing the tapes and that kind of thing, I think it might have been smart for her. She took a political hit, and. And it probably won't hurt her to try to get out in front of the others.
Is she going to have Democratic competition, or is it all going to be from the Republicans?
Oh, I'd bet on it.
Oh, yeah.
My guess is that she did it now, not so much because of Republican opponents, but because of people within the own party.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
I think they've sensed that she's probably weaker than she was the last time around.
Okay. This is becoming the Nick Oxner show, but that's okay because your wife was on the first direct flight to Cuba from Charlotte.
Charlotte.
She went to cover both that flight and Castro's death. What have you heard? She's still there?
She is. She's should be on the plane.
Tell people who your wife is.
Sarah Blake Morgan, the wonderful, enterprising, multimedia journalist.
If you do say so yourself.
That's right.
On WBTV. What have you heard from her about Cuba?
Yeah, in fact, she called while we were talking on the show. she actually she had planned to go cover this trip for months, months in advance to go cover the first flight and stay there for a couple days. And boy, what timing, huh?
Yeah.
And so she gets down there. They're in their period of mourning. But it's interesting. She says that as she has gone around and talked with folks in Cuba, and she's in Havana, that she cannot find anyone who seems to legitimately hold a grudge or an ill feeling about the Cuban government. And of course, we all know that it's...
Because they can't say what they really think?
Well, and I said to her, I was like, of course, they're afraid to say something. She said, the people that she spoke with seem honest and sincerely happy with their lives and with happy thoughts and feelings. And you can see all of her reporting on WBTV.com. She's been feeding back.
What a shill. this is an American Airlines flight.
Yes.
How often is it going to fly to Cuba each week? Because it's obviously a connector. People from Charlotte aren't going to Cuba on a regular basis. So obviously everything's funneling into Douglas and then going out from there.
That's correct. And it was Charlotte, Douglas, and then Miami are the two hubs where American has flights going out from. I believe it was daily service. And then Sarah said to me last night that she'd heard that they were already scaling back their regular schedule because it wasn't as getting the traffic that they wanted. She said it was about – they're about – maybe 80 people on the flight there on Wednesday.
I just threw that story in there to break up the constant conversation about elections, because we're going to have yet another election. On Tuesday, a federal court ordered North Carolina to hold a special legislative election next year, 2017, after 28 House and Senate districts are redrawn to comply with a gerrymandering ruling. Take us back. When did that ruling come down and why? Take us back to why we're having, why they have to redraw the elections. I know that it affected this election in some ways.
Different court cases?
This is too darn confusing.
There are multiple court challenges that have been filed to lines, various political boundaries in North Carolina.
Right.
This one challenged legislative boundaries along the same lines that the others have, you know, the congressional gerrymandering cases at the Supreme Court on Monday, by the way, the U.S. Supreme Court. But this one is the congressional gerrymandering, essentially.
Legislative.
Yeah.
It's so confusing.
Right. The legislative case and basically, much like in the congressional case, they said you improperly considered race and other factors in drawing these boundaries. Right. They have said the same thing about these legislative districts. And that ruling came out months ago, but we were all too distracted with the congressional stuff to really remember that, and HB2 to really remember that.
It's really an unusual ruling because they said not only do you have to redraw these, and that'll be 28 districts plus any others that are affected when they redraw the lines. But it also requires them to hold another election this fall after only 1 year of the term. And that is one of the things that the critics of the ruling are challenging.
Yeah. So there'll be a primary in August and September of 2017 and a general election in November. The winners will begin serving when? 2018, January 2018.
Right away.
Because there's another election.
They'll run for re-election again in 2018. Yeah.
The court said that the wrong that was done to the voters by redrawing these districts and having these unfairly balanced districts was enough to make them –
pales in comparison to the injury caused by allowing citizens to continue to be represented by legislators elected pursuant to a racial gerrymander.
Therefore, they justified making it just a one-year term.
But in the original ruling, they allowed the vote to go forward, I believe, because they said there wasn't enough time.
That was before this fall's election.
Yeah, that was
right.
We really don't have enough time to go back and tell you to, because they had just done that with the congressional race, and they're like, well, we're really out of time now. It's been described by legislative Republicans who obviously don't want this as an overreach by the courts, of course. But specifically, they point out that the state constitution says that voters will elect representatives to 2-year terms, and so they say this is against the state constitution because they're only serving a 1-year term.
Doesn't the federal constitution trump, even in the Obama years, doesn't it trump the
because we have the states' rights,
You could do a whole show just on that question.
Yeah, we could talk about the 10th Amendment, which,
I'm sure we will. They have not yet redrawn these districts, have they?
No.
They have until March, I think.
Yeah, and I assume
– And then they have to be approved by some entity, do they not?
Theoretically, yes. But
what entity would that be?
I would think the courts.
The federal courts?
The courts.
Same court that
The state has an argument that the previously drawn districts were okayed by the Obama Justice Department.
But that has not held up. Were the congressional districts, and that wasn't the courts
don't
care.
More of a political statement, I think.
Yeah, the courts do not seem to care about that.
Okay.
But, the long session starts January 11th, and which we have many things to tackle in the long session, but this will certainly be one of them.
And as you mentioned, there is a congressional gerrymandering case before the Supreme Court in North Carolina, the federal Supreme Court.
Yes.
About North Carolina on Monday.
Monday morning.
What might happen there?
What would happen since we have a panel of only 8 justices still?
Four tag.
Yeah.
Entirely possible.
Very, very well could. Stay tuned.
Okay. We have to take a break. When we come back, the River District is coming. Wildfires are burning. And Dylan Roof is going to represent himself in his hate crimes trial, the federal trial, in Charleston. We're coming right back at Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and the Fresh Market, carrying new items in their Charlotte locations, from baby and pet care items to organics and gluten-free foods. Details at thefreshmarket.com. And the Original Mattress Company, providing mattresses and bedding hand-built in the Charlotte factory and offered direct to the consumer. More info at originalmattress.com. The weekly news roundup continues on the Diane Rehm Show, coming up in 20 minutes at 10 o'clock. President-elect Donald Trump starts a victory tour with a stop in Cincinnati. Nancy Pelosi is re-elected House Minority Leader, and the Mecklenburg County DA says CMPD officer who killed Keith Lamont Scott will not face charges. We're on the national news, and we will continue with ours as well, coming right up.
It's your world. We help you explore it.
Let's conclude a train ride through Pakistan. NPR's Philip Reeves has spent many years covering that massive country.
It's your community. We help you understand it.
It's the city's biggest project since the 1990s, when development began at Ballantyne in South Charlotte.
Morning Edition on WFAE is an essential way to start your day and stay connected to your world. Listen weekday mornings from 5 to 9 on 90.7 WFAE.
It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE and WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. It's the local news roundup. David Borax is here from WFAE News. Eric Frazier from the Charlotte Observer. Glenn Birkins, editor-publisher of QCityMetro.com. And Nick Oxner, reporter for WBTV News. 1,400 acres along the Catawba River are about to rival the development we now call Ballantyne. It's slightly smaller, but there's more office space coming our way. And Charlotte City Council unanimously approved the zoning for this river district, as it's being called. Did this approval come as any surprise to anybody?
I don't think so. Yeah, this development has been in the works since 2014, although it wasn't made public until earlier this year, maybe March. There was a lot of discussion at the council. There was a public hearing that had mostly supporters and only one opponent, and the council approved it. And they did, get some concessions out of the developer as well. There's an affordable housing component that we can talk about in more detail, but anyway.
Well, there's a bunch of different components in this. We did a whole show on it, as a matter of fact, and I don't remember all the particulars, but there'll be apartments, there'll be shops and retail and restaurants and more office space than Ballantyne has, and I've forgotten the amount, and parks. And schools, they've set aside an area of the property for, I think, what, two CMA schools?
Two school sites and one or two fire station sites they're also looking for as well, because you need these public services
but
to go along
with all this. They're setting aside these properties, these pieces of land for, I think, I may get this wrong, 6 years.
I think the schools are 10 years.
Okay, well, then the county has 10 years to either fish or cut bait. Does that mean they have to put money into the deal?
They got to come up with the money to buy these sites.
Okay.
But the other thing to remember about this is a 20 to 30 year project. So, you know, none of this is going to happen very fast. Within 10 years, CMS has to come up with the money or at least an idea of how they'll pay for it and where they'll go and, you know.
And the city has committed $45 million in infrastructure improvements. What will that money go to?
Well, it'll mainly go, I think, to infrastructure, streets, and other improvements inside this development.
Because right now it's pretty much a wilderness, isn't it?
Yeah. But one thing that strikes me and that I haven't heard a whole lot of talk about with this particular project is the impact that it will have traffic-wise on Interstate 485 through there. Now, that we typically tend to think of that stretch of 485 over on the airport side as kind of a sleepy stretch, but I've driven through there recently a couple of times at rush hour, and it is gridlock over there, even though there's not a lot of people living over there right now.
But isn't that the flyover that goes to the 85 towards Spartanburg? Isn't that part of the problem?
Right. Yeah. Because
85 comes to a stop.
Right, But there's no provisions in this plan for widening of 485, although 485 is three lanes through there. But you think back about 10 years ago to Ballantyne and how the State Highway Department did not foresee you know, the impact that Ballantyne was going to have on traffic down there, and we had gridlock. I think we may be in for something like that.
We're
going to
be in for that. Well, it's going to be like the Capitol Beltway in Washington, which is bumper to bumper 24/7 in both directions, and it's a slog.
Don't forget, there'll be a toll lane on 485 before long. That's that whole stretch of highway on
485. Near Ballantyne,
yeah.
The other thing that's happening kind of alongside of this is that there, you know, some of this money will go to create new roads and streets in the area where this would be. And the city is also working on other projects to improve the roads that go out that way. I mean, West Boulevard will see a major transformation in this project. And Wilkinson Boulevard is going to become the main thoroughfare that it once was into the city. And I think one of the assumptions is that some of the folks that live out here will be office workers uptown and that they will come downtown. And you're not going to get on I-485 to come downtown. So, but again, this is off in the future.
But is anyone talking about public transportation?
When's the purple line coming? That's what I...
Exactly.
So that's that's mentioned in the plan that it will go out there to the airport. I guess you'll have to drive your car to a transit stop at the end of the new line and, you know, find your way into town that way.
And was it John Autry who really raised some questions about the walkability of this neighborhood and bikes and what have you? And I think some other council members were generally interested in, are we going to continue just relying on people driving their cars, or are we going to think about some other thing?
Well, it's being designed as a walkable neighborhood, but the problem is getting people to it and out of it, right?
Yeah.
Dennis emails, have Charlotte officials included Gaston County, especially Belmont, in their decision-making? Is it going to have a massive impact just 100? It is going to have a massive impact just 100 yards away across the Catawba.
Well, I know there's
include Gaston County. Yeah, we don't really do a lot of that in our planning.
Well, I know they're actually
the
they're
Belmont
actually
Tunnel will become a reality.
Well, there are plans. They talk a lot in that plan about a bridge.
I know.
To Gaston County, a new bridge, although that's not funded, I don't think,
no,
at this point. So they are thinking about it, whether or not they're actually doing a whole lot.
I was joking about the Belmont Tunnel. That's an old radio joke from WBT in the 1950s, I got to tell you. But there is a tunnel going in on the toll roads northbound on I-77, which I did not know about until I read about it in the paper this morning. They're going to get ready to set off explosives to put the tunnel in. Do you guys know about this?
It's not that big a tunnel.
I mean, I don't care. Who knew?
It's going under a giant berm.
Okay.
Yeah. I mean, there's a lot of work that – so people –
we're going to have a subway.
People who have been following this project are about to get hit hard in Charlotte. I mean, they're shutting down the high occupancy lane that's coming in from the north, and that's going to affect traffic in the coming weeks. And there's a lot of work going to happen in the uptown area, new ramps onto 277, all of that.
And it's going to be a lot different, you know, when Huntersville is dealing with gridlock. You know, the people in uptown, oh, that's Huntersville, boo-hoo. But we'll see what it's like when it hits right here in the city center, you know.
And it's going to.
Without a doubt.
Yeah. Wildfires are still burning in the North Carolina mountains, although they seem to be under control here. We got some heavy rain up there for the first time in a very long time this week. Did that help a lot or just a little bit with those fires, or do we know?
I think it did help.
Some.
Yeah, I was just looking this morning. There's a state website you can go to check up on the fires, and there's still, I think, 19 fires or 17 fires listed. And most of them are in the, you know, later stages of containment. And containment means that the firefighters have a line around it and they're pretty sure it's not going to spread beyond where it is. But we still have thousands of acres affected by this.
How come we're not getting the smoke we got in Charlotte from those fires earlier? And I'm assuming it's still smoky in the mountains in places, but why are we getting it?
We're not seeing the kind of wildfires that we had you know, a few weeks ago when the smoke was traveling east. And these are, you know, pretty much under control.
You were up there in upstate South Carolina, and also you flew over western North Carolina. Was that for the news or for a joyride, or what did you see?
A little bit of both, I think. But I will say that the going out there, you know, I saw the smoke in the air in Charlotte here. I was breathing it. I got asthma, so it was affecting me.
Right.
But when I got out there and saw it, it was breathtaking and not in a good way. I was in upstate South Carolina for another story, and I came around this curve on Route 11, if you know that, near the North Carolina line. I came around this curve, and the side of this mountain was just totally in smoke billowing up from it. It was something surreal. And when I went up in the airplane the next day, we flew over and between the fires near Chimney Rock and South Mountain State Park. And you know, the South Mountain fire, the smoke was kind of creeping towards us. And we actually were not allowed to fly directly over the fires because they have a temporary no-fly zone there. But one of the people that I was with, Sam Perkins, the Catawba Riverkeeper, described it as like something out of Harry Potter where these ominous clouds are coming towards you. And it was quite remarkable.
Of course, there are wildfires in the mountainous areas in several different states, including Tennessee, where Gatlinburg was just devastated by this. And I stayed in the hotel that at one point that caught fire in Gatlinburg a long time ago. In North Carolina, they have apprehended somebody and accused him of starting these fires. And according to a report in the paper this morning, he has said he did it. Yeah. And he did it because he was
bored. Just, wow. He didn't, he should have just, what's that right to remain silent? Which one of the rights is that?
Yeah,
someone should have
reminded him of that. Yeah.
I actually heard on the way in this morning that they're saying someone started these as well, whether intentional or
so
by
that
accident.
Kind of brings us to the atmosphere right now. We're in this long drought that we've had. It's affecting all these states, Georgia, Tennessee, North Carolina, South Carolina. It's one of the worst droughts we've had since about 2008. So the conditions right now are ripe for fires. And, you know, it may have been somebody starting some of these, as we've seen in these examples, but it may just have been something as simple as flicking a cigarette or parking your car on a pile of grass that catches fire. I mean, there's so many, you know, a campfire at a website, I mean, at a park. And, you know, it really could be humans' fault in a lot of these cases because of these conditions. And it's something that, you know, we have no control over that.
You know you've gone digital when you have a campfire at a website. And a little levity every once in a while doesn't hurt, I suppose. A federal judge is allowing Dylan Roof, that he's the Charleston shooter, to represent himself in his hate crimes trial in Charleston. He's charged in the June 2015 killings of 9 worshipers at Charleston's Emmanuel AME Church. This is a death penalty case, and the federal government is pursuing this as a hate crimes case because South Carolina does not have any hate crimes law on the book. Could his representing himself in this lead to a mistrial?
Sure, it's entirely
possible. Is that
why
he's doing it?
I mean, I guess in theory he could do such a terrible job of representing himself and make crazy statements and, you know, appear irrational. Mm-hmm. And
well, you were there yesterday. You slipped into the courtroom yesterday.
Yeah, I was there yesterday.
And they're interviewing or they're choosing jurors.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Did he speak?
Yeah, he did. And he was very cogent, articulate, intelligent seeming. He was asking the right questions.
What kinds of questions did he ask? I wouldn't know how to do that.
So well, he had the lawyers whose services he has declined are still sitting next to him, and they sort of, you know, you could see him sort of whispering with them, but he was asking things like, can you, you know, what are your feelings on the death penalty? Do you feel like anytime someone gets murdered, that person should be put to death, you know? And he was, you know, he was doing the things that lawyers typically do.
So is he really representing himself, or is he simply being the front piece for this because he wants the spotlight?
I think at one point the judge ordered him, you have to address me directly. There was some, I wasn't in the courtroom, but apparently, you know, he was talking to the lawyers so much that he kind of had to remind him of that.
Has he said why he wants to represent himself?
I didn't hear him speak on why yesterday, but I did hear him ask for more time before the trial is actually supposed to start next week, early next week, after the jury is impaneled. And he did stand up at one point and ask the judge, can I have a couple of days? I just have this is a lot to absorb, and I have a lot, I need to try and get prepared, and I don't feel like I'm ready.
Yeah. His reasons for representing himself, that was all discussed in closed hearing. And those records are sealed.
Okay. Some, including former State Senator Malcolm Graham, whose sister died in those shootings, says that this creates another, this is a quote, another platform for him to express his racist views. If he does that, couldn't that turn the jury against him?
Absolutely. Sure. And actually, that's my number one concern as well, that once the trial starts, that he might use this as a platform to attempt to justify what he did.
So this is a hate crime, a federal hate crime trial that has a death penalty attached to it. There will also be a second trial, a state trial, which does not have the death penalty attached to it. How does one affect the other?
I believe it does.
I think South Carolina. You're talking South Carolina.
How does one trial affect the other?
I don't think in theory.
And if he's sentenced in the federal trial and he's sentenced to death in the federal trial, will there be a second trial?
Well, that's a good question. I mean, and that's up to the state prosecutors. I think they probably would go ahead and do it just, you know, for the sake of completeness and politics. But one trial does not necessarily bleed over into the other. They're two legally separate proceedings.
South Carolina Governor Nikki Haley evidently was at a ribbon-cutting ceremony yesterday, probably her last as the governor of North Carolina, because she's going to New York to be the ambassador to the United Nations if she's confirmed by the Congress, by the Senate. I think that they do the confirmations, don't they?
Yeah.
Donald Trump has appointed her UN ambassador with very little foreign policy experience to her credit. Why did he choose her?
Well, I can tell you my theory, which is just that he needed he needed to diversify his cabinet.
But she was a Marco Rubio supporter, not a Donald Trump supporter.
But that's part of, you know, I think that's also part of diversifying his cabinet, ideologically and politically as well.
I think it was a good move for the party, though, as well. She's a rising star.
Yeah.
And though she has no foreign policy experience now, this is going to really burnish that part of her her resume and really help her in the years and decades to come.
Her rivalry with Pat McCrory that McCrory always used to joke about, it's not much of a rivalry anymore.
This shows what's going on behind the scenes here, that, you know, Trump is pulling a lot of the strings, but he's also got to work with the Republicans, and I'm sure they said, we got to find a place for Nikki Haley.
Yeah, because during the campaign, she said some fairly thinly veiled negative things about Donald Trump, and then she said when she was her appointment was announced, she said, this month's elections have brought exciting changes to America.
I think Mitt Romney wrote that for her.
Zing.
And the ambassador to the United Nations has become a cabinet rank position. That started with the George W. Bush administration. What does that mean, that it's a cabinet rank position?
She has the ear of the president.
And that she sits on, you know, I think it is a recognition of its importance and the influence within the administration.
Well, fortunately for all of us, we are out of time and do not have time to discuss the Panthers.
Good.
So we won't.
To discuss.
We end with John Tice, whose cover of our Charlotte Talks theme we're hearing in the background right now. Eddie Farrell and Frank Guzek, all of whom joined us in the studio this morning, are responsible for that. And a special thanks to Jennifer Worsham, who departs as our hostess here in the Spirit Square studio today.